Coming from the Lower Haight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. Welcome once again to the Are You Serious Show, and we're going to be talking to V. Vale once again, which should be fun. And but I've been worrying. I've been thinking that maybe this show isn't as good as it is. What do you think?
Well, you know, you could travel 10 light years away and see what people think of it in the future.
Well, all right.
That's as good as it will be.
That's as good as it will be. Anyway, right. Jeff Deal is here, and Diane Brown clearly has something she wants to talk about. Welcome, Diane.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up. I am so excited because soon we can all travel like Q from, you know, Star Trek's The Next Generation. Apparently soon, well, maybe in 5 years' time, we'll be able to travel from Earth to Mars in 3 hours, or as I mentioned, 10 light years away in 80 days. Now, this is not just a new episode of Battlestar Galactica, but an extraordinary new engine based on the Heim quantum theory, or HQT, as I like to call it, developed by Burkhard Heim in the 1950s. Theoretically, this engine works by creating an intense magnetic field. Now, this would produce a gravitational field, and that would result in thrust for the spacecraft. And if this is a large enough magnetic field, then the craft would slip into a different dimension where speed of light is faster.
Now, would it allow me, I mean, if it can get me to Mars in what?
3 hours.
3 hours?
Would you go?
Can it get me from like Mill Valley to San Francisco in about 30 seconds?
It should be able to, but you know, local travel takes a lot longer.
And then, I mean, Mars, you can't. Mars ain't no place to raise your kids, and I think it's cold as hell, isn't it?
I think so.
There's no one even there to raise them if you did.
But, you know, the U.S. Air Force is interested in this, and they will raise them for you. And apparently at present, the U.S. Department of Energy has a device known as the Z Machine, which will actually, it's capable of generating the kind of magnetic field required to drive the engine.
When did the current speed of light become too slow? Well, are we really that close to, you know?
Look, people are not happy with how long it takes them to download this show, so the speed of light obviously needs to be picked up. Now, there are a lot of physicists who doubt Heim's theory, and apparently Burkhard Heim was very secretive, and his theory was never subjected to peer review. But U.S. Department of Energy scientists say if this theory, Heim's quantum theory, withstands future scrutiny, they will begin testing, and if it's proven, a prototype will be available in as little as 5 years.
It never ceases to amaze me, the scientific stuff that the government take seriously. And maybe there's some legitimacy there. But it's always surprising the stuff that they'll at least experiment with. And, you know, they are the foremost mutants of our culture, actually.
Well, NASA is also contacted.
And DARPA is involved in this as well, I think.
Yes.
They mentioned, because DARPA is just DARPA fucking rules. We're here with V. Vale, publisher of research publications. Among his more recent publications has been J.G. Ballard Conversations and J.G. Ballard Quotes. He's also pretty well known for having done, with the punk community, for having done Search and Destroy in the 1970s. And everybody is familiar, or most people are familiar with Modern Primitives. Let me ask you about Modern Primitives to start off. This is a hugely influential book, and I wonder how you feel about the way that the a lot of the stuff that's in modern primitives has become so fashionable and cliched and almost de rigueur among hipsters that you have to have, you know, the ampling through your penis and the
you mean you can say penis on this show?
We can say anything we want on this show.
I
hope we don't shock you.
Well, you know, I mean, aren't you limiting your audience that way?
No, I don't think so. Not today.
Thank you.
Well, for one thing, you know, people have forgotten. But when I did Modern Primitives, nobody was getting tattooed. And nobody had heard of body piercing. And, you know, the New York Times said that's the book that sparked this tidal wave of activity all over the planet. And if I'd only had a bigger distributor, I'm sure I could have sold literally 100 times more copies than the handful. And so, unfortunately, it didn't quite pay off in financial, you know, terms. But all I was trying to do in the project, again, I go back to Claude Lévi-Strauss, who worked among various tribes that did kind of tattooing in the Amazon basin. And I just looked at this as an art form. Okay, yeah. Tattooing and body piercing is a legitimate art form because prior to any publishing, the kind of art besides Surrealist and Dada that I liked was primitive, naive. And I just thought, you know, that your body is a canvas, and this is a legitimate art form. So why is there a huge social stigma against it, you know? Right. And so in the book, Modern Primitives, I tried to give every possible reason why you should maybe do these things with no negatives. That's a key thing to speak of. And aside from, you know, somebody saying, well, I think not everybody should get a tattoo. Well, I don't have any, so I followed that advice.
But, so you told everybody else to get a tattoo.
I didn't tell anyone.
Now are you investing in tattoo removal?
Look, we're talking potentials. All my books are about potentials. And what's the potential? Well, everyone has the potential to become an artist that way.
A lot of the people also, I mean, spoke to the experience of having these things done and the experience of having it. It is a way of getting high in some ways, actually.
Well, I think, I don't know about that, but I think everybody, whether they know it or
altering
not.
Altering your body is a change of consciousness.
It's a little more basic. I think everybody, whether they know it or not, is in the process of constructing their own mythology, actually.
Right.
Yeah, their own mythopoetic, dimensional sense of, you know, inherent, genetic inheritance, you could almost say, except I don't want to peg ideas to DNA. Otherwise, it'd be so nice if we could inherit ideas genetically. I don't think you can. But I thought, again, with Modern Primitives, all my books are about kind of that horrible word empowerment, but it's true. And, you know, they're about opening you up to potentials inside you that you didn't know you had. That's what punk was all about. You know, well, you didn't know you were an artist. Well, you know, you're in this band. There's nobody else to make the poster.
Right.
You better make a poster.
Right.
You know, and of course, what I loved about Situationism was they invented this word détournement, which means, you know, you take a million-dollar graphic from somebody, or, you know, an ad or whatever that someone spent $1 zillion making, and you put a subversive slogan on it.
Exactly, reframing everything.
And
of course, that's gone back and forth now. The mainstream culture takes stuff that's being done by the underground, and they deturn.
Yeah,
what is
I don't want to dignify it by using the word deturn. They rip off in a really bad way, I think.
It is painful.
It is.
I've commented on the Industrial Culture Handbook, actually, that when you read through a lot of the interviews, you have artists who all say they sort of want to shock people out of complacency. They want to stir up audiences and so forth. And then the people who go to see them are going to be people who know exactly what to expect when they go to see them. Does that turn into sort of a circle jerk after a while?
Oh, yeah.
Here's the problem. First of all, speaking of industrial culture, to me, industrial culture was a more intellectual, extreme branch of punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. These people were the smartest people, I think. They're the most scholarly. They'd read the most. They're the most worldly wise. They'd traveled. And the industrial culture handbook, for the handful of people that bought it, is really a manual of education of really extreme punk rock culture. And it's true that there weren't any frontiers. I mean, there weren't any boundaries, I should say. There's always frontiers. But and the most interesting artistic creative work is always at the borders, at the borderlands, because everything else has sort of been done. And so with industrial culture, you know, people like us were saying, you know, who needs guitars? Who needs
right,
basses?
Yeah,
who needs drums?
Yeah,
let's just
cool.
make pure noise. All we need is a tape recorder to make music with.
And it wasn't just music. It was, you know, Mark Crowleen and S.
And subliminals. That was a big thing. A lot of the early punks put subliminals in their recordings, or rather the early industrials.
Right.
And as far as shock goes, well, what would be shocking today? I suppose it's to have a kid and raise a kid in a, you know, as subversively as you can. I mean, you know, you don't stay young forever in your 20s.
Right.
And, we're not on a treadmill where we're all going to be eternally young forever, even though we're in a culture that tries to pretend like you can be in your 20s and your 70s, like Jane Fonda or something. Nothing against her either, really, because she certainly did her incendiary thing back in the 60s and early 70s. I mean, we all do things. It's, you know, and what's shocking yesterday isn't shocking today. And, you know, you have to, shock is only meaningful in terms of context. Like, what's going on now? Well, if everyone's on stage acting like Gigi Allen or, you know, someone cutting themselves live and, you know, killing a dog on stage
it's
or something.
Terribly shocking, then, isn't it?
Well,
right.
if everyone's doing that, well, then you're certainly not going to shock me, at least.
Well, I mean, the shock we're talking about in the positive sense of shock, I mean, it's like information. There has to be a distinction. It has to be different from something that has come before in order for it to change consciousness. And
you know, you keep using the word information, are you? But, you know, I think I'm one of the first people in print who used the word in the industrial culture handbook, information overload.
Right.
We felt back then we were already in the age of information overload. There was too much to process. And, you know, the challenge now is to find quality, not quantity.
Right. But if you're not processing it, then it's not information.
What do you mean?
Well, it has to connect to somebody's awareness in order for it to really be information.
Well, information.
I mean, what they call information, this stuff that lays out there that you know that you're talking about, there's too much of.
But it isn't.
That's
well,
not
information.
But Gregory Bateson, who really wrote about information theory, information is in the distinction. It has to be something. There has to be novelty in it.
Been forgotten here is discrimination. No one has it anymore. Everything's flat. Everything's the same. You know, your blue coat is as good as your black coat, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a complete lack of discrimination, I think, and prioritizing. And I think we're in such a heavily information, as you call it, immersive environment that another condition that nobody enjoys anymore is interiority. Time by yourself, time without information, time in which you just think and just write, maybe.
By the very use of the term downtime, it almost has a negative connotation.
Yeah, like you're just switching yourself off or something.
Whereas
that can be the most valuable time.
You hit on something. There are so much semantic undertones and subliminal, powerful, emotionally powerful meanings to the most simplest words we use,
true.
Like downtime. I mean, so many of our language, so much of our language is already weighted and in a negative way.
That's true.
And you're not alert to it. Like, you're the first person who alerted me to the negative potential emotional, you know, penumbra or whatever you call it behind the word downtime.
Well, there you know?
Well, we're going to take a couple of minutes of downtime to listen to a tune, and then we're going to come back and finish up with V-Vail. We're back with V-Vail, and I want to talk to you about the life of a publisher. The publishing industry has been in free fall. I certainly know that the mainstream publishing industry is having a very hard time, and alternative publishers who I've talked to are also feeling the pinch, probably worse than the rest of them. And what do you think is going on? Is this an experience that you're having, and what do you attribute it to?
Well, let's go back to that word interiority. Because that's what's missing in most people's lives today. I mean, you know, they've got their iPod with every song that's ever been recorded on it, you know, with the new 60 gig one. And, everywhere you go, you see millions of corporate ads. I forgot how many. The average New Yorker going to work sees something like 10,000 corporate logos, some massive amount every day.
Nice.
So what's the antidote to this incredibly oppressive media environment we're in, which of course has succeeded in taking away huge chunks of most people's identity and, you know, everything that made them. And, well, you could say reading a book. Well, what do you do to read a book? If you're me, you don't have the stereo going because you're, no one even knows what to read means anymore. To me, it's a very active process. I've got to have a ruler, a pencil, and a dictionary. And I read very slowly. And every time I don't know a word, I look it up. And I mark my favorite passages. And if a writer, you know, is writing all these words and sentences that don't make sense, I probably stop reading, or I argue back on the page.
That's valuable.
Yeah, and
so you're really engaged.
Of course, like anyone should be.
Right.
I mean, I try, of course, to only expose myself to books by absolute primo and intelligent, insightful people that have ever lived on the planet, who graced me with a book, and. And that's, you know, again, it goes back to that problem of interiority. I think we've raised a whole generation of people on TV, and they're absolutely incapable of being alone in a room reading without some electronic noise going on or so-called music. And because of this, no one wants to read books anymore, and they don't go to bookstores. There's a huge Barnes & Noble at Fisherman's Wharf near where I live, and I go there once in a while just to monitor it. There's right. nobody in there. You know, you won't be buying a book without going to a bookstore, and people are not in the bookstores.
There is definitely
unless there's a Starbucks in the bookstore, then they're in there having coffee, which is sad but true.
Now you mentioned only reading writers that seem to have something really important to convey.
Now,
who would you aside from the people that you publish yourself? Who interests you now?
Well, okay, I'm always going back and reading Burroughs and Ballard. I'm always finding stuff I'd totally forgotten or didn't notice the first time. They will never lie to you, these two.
Right.
And that's important because most people do lie to you. Practically all these writers that you read, they're lying to you on a number of levels by what they didn't include, because they want to kiss someone else's you-know-what,
right.
and because they're so incredibly hyper-self-promotional these days. That they're just afraid to tell the truth about anything. I don't care what the topic is. They don't want to step on anyone's toes because, you know, they're also into networking and synergy and all this BS that, you know, it's completely polluted everything. It's the structure now, I think, that I'm attacking. The way, if you are lucky enough to get a corporate media book deal, let's say, and there's only like four publishers left, really,
right?
And they're not competing anymore for books. Literary agents complain that
right.
well, we can't have bidding anymore because there's no one left to bid.
Nobody's bidding. No, and I mean, some of the major book companies aren't even giving advances anymore. It's
yeah.
a really deteriorated.
Well,
situation.
Yeah.
Are there any new writers after Burroughs and Ballard that have knocked you over?
Boy, it's been what I call slim pickings.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I mean, I read paragraphs, sentences uh-huh. that I like here and there, but I don't read entire books. I mean, well, you know, Michelle Welbeck,
no.
you know, I read Platform by him. He's pretty controversial somewhere, if anyone's uh-huh. ever heard of him. And, you know, in Platform, you know, he attacked more or less the advertising agency. You know how ad agencies work,
right?
And that was fun. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I really would like to know a lot more about how ad agencies work, how advertising works.
It's fascinating
because they definitely get you, and it's on an emotional, subliminal, subconscious level. You know, it's right. not
to make you feel incomplete without this object or product or experience.
Yeah, and they brand themselves on you whether. Even if you're like me, who tries never to go out and be exposed.
Well, yeah, back then, those are things that come back to Ballard and Burroughs. They both worked with how people try to infect other people's minds with stuff they want them to believe or that they want to sell to them. And
well,
language
is a virus, as Burroughs pointed
right.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And... I mean, it would. I don't know who invents a lot of these sound bites that grab you.
Right.
I really don't know who's inventing the language that's we're using now. But that's certainly something to investigate, because you know your language also limits you.
Well, Burroughs, of course, came up along with Brian Geisen with the cut-up technique,
yeah.
Which also, I mean, is very much used in other forms of media today, in mashups and this and that. People are cutting up media forms.
Well,
do you think, I mean, that's a way of deconditioning language? Do you think Burroughs was correct?
I think surrealism gave us the entire arsenal of all we need. You know, to like not only be for everyone to be an artist. See, that's my utopian society. Every single person on the planet is a creative artist in many media, not just one. And the surrealist taught you that, and no one ever reads them, of course, because we're in a society that wants to raise everyone to be a consumer, not an artist. And the Surrealists gave you all the tools to prove to you. You know, again, you go into any kindergarten, every kid there is painting, being in theater, you know, dancing. They're doing all the art forms, every single kid there. And then the question is, how does this go away and why and who's profiting by it? But, you know, that's why I like punk so much. By economic reasons and because it was easy, everybody was making their own posters, their own. People couldn't even play an instrument, were writing songs a week later. It was an amazing time. What Surrealism gives you is it tells you to keep a dream journal and pay attention to your dreams, because many painters have gotten their ideas in dreams. Anyone could. Just think about your dreams. Everyone's had probably hundreds of indelible images that could be paintings if they only knew how to be a painter. And then the Surrealists invented all these games to stir up creativity, you know, like, well, they also told you to pay attention to the dimension of time by being alert for what you call objective chance, or a chance encounter with the marvelous, as they might have called it, or just chance encounters in general, because I know chance encounters have certainly changed my life a great deal, and they were just that. They weren't, you know, anything that logic could have brought me. And so, the Exquisite Corpse was like a game you'd play in which you start a poem or a drawing on a very folded up piece of paper. Then the next person around the table has to complete it, and you keep going around the table, and then you see what you have. And depending on who's at the table, it can be very interesting. So your dreams and traumas, things that happen to you, are a huge source of artistic visual inspiration and creativity. And then music, I mean, you know, like John Cage taught us to hear music in our environment just walking around, the creak of a door, you know, the rush of a subway coming up, all kinds of things can be tape recorded and cut up into music. And there's all kinds of musical sounds actually in the environment. And so, you know, the bad thing that kind of constricts people and shuts them all down is actually your aesthetics. Mm-hmm. You know, the aesthetics that that you have, you know, somehow embraced. They actually function as filters to shut out an awful lot. And Surrealism kind of gives you the biggest possible range of filters, so you can still, like, you know, walk down the street without being run over.
Thank you, Vale. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but that leaves people with a lot of stuff to think about.
Thank you.
Tell people how to look you up.
Oh, yes, the www.researchpubs.com, you know, that's where we're at. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Amin.
We'd like to thank V. Vale from Research Publications for joining us once again on our show. The music you heard was DJ Pantshead doing the Panasonic Incident. Next week, San Francisco Chronicle columnist Neva Chonin discusses her hipsterectomy. Are You Serious show is part of the Mondo Globo Network. Check out all of our shows at mondoglobo.net. Thanks for listening, and don't be afraid of the dark.